This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with political and social activist Tom Hayden.
Tom Hayden has stood against war his entire political life. Today we'll talk to him about how to end the war with Iraq.
We'll learn about the case of Breonna Waters, a mother and violin teacher who may face 20 years in prison.
This government is going after the Green Movement with a vengeance. This is only the latest outrage in their attempt to suppress environmentalism.
We'll also hear the third part of An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life, moderated by Michael Ratner. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
We're really pleased to have Tom Hayden with us here today. Tom is the author of many books, including most recently, Ending the War in Iraq. In the early 60s, he was one of the principal organizers of Students for a Democratic Society and the author of the famous Port Huron Statement. He was one of the co-conspirators in the Chicago 8 trial. It's actually a trial that the Center for Constitutional Rights was involved in. Tom got 5 years in that trial, but on appeal, got it reversed. In the early 70s, he made trips to North Vietnam in an effort to end the war. Later, he served 18 years in the California legislature. Tom, give us some of your perceptions about how we can build a movement to end that war, what some of the key issues are, and where you think the anti-war movement ought to be going.
Well, thank you so much. The newest book is actually 50 years of my writings, if you can believe that. I entered the University of Michigan 50 years ago, and it's just hard to believe so many of the lessons of Vietnam have been undone, and here we are in the fifth or sixth year of Iraq, maybe the 15th year if you include the sanctions. My conclusion from my experience is that getting out of wars, ending them, is very difficult and unpredictable because the establishment that is to blame has its reputation to protect, especially if they claim to be number one. And so there's a long history of administrations, usually Republican, blaming Democrats for losing China, losing Vietnam, losing this, losing that. And the Bush administration simply wants to get through 2008 and leave a poison pill called Iraq on the desk of the Democrats if they win the presidency. What will get the war finished, I think, is people power pressuring against the pillars of the policy. War-making establishments need public opinion. That's gone in this country and in Iraq and around the world. They need money. The budgetary crisis is making funding the war much more extreme, and opposition is broader. They need troops endlessly. The army in particular is strained to the breaking point. You could list other pillars, but this means working at the grassroots to oppose the war among those people who are still fence-sitters, pressuring military recruiters, and broadening the anti-war coalition to include groups who are heavily hurt by the cost of the war, is the way to go. And eventually, without the pillars, the war policy just comes to a point of collapse. How it exactly ends, we can't say. But I think that's the general strategy for ending it.
Tom, I want to credit you. I read the Port Huron Statement when I started NYU Law School back in 64. It moved me immensely. I identified with SDS. It launched me into anti-war activity when I got back to Wisconsin. I remember in those days, the things that we did, which were so grassroots, we would actually go out and talk to people. We wouldn't send them emails. We'd organize meetings in dormitories. We'd have meetings in Madison. We'd have regional meetings. We'd have national meetings. We rubbed shoulders with other people and tried to recruit them into an organization. And then periodically, we had those huge demonstrations, which I think were very effective in showing other people out in America that they weren't alone, and especially in showing the troops that they weren't alone.
Yeah, I think that community organizing approach shouldn't belong to Barack Obama alone. I mean, it's the heritage of social movements. It's the heritage of the anti-war movement. And I think it may have been replaced, and there's pros and cons, but replaced by the internet organizing, which is more faceless. There's room for all of it, and I do think we spend too much time talking to each other. And I try to spend a good part of the day talking to non-left, non-activist people, and always have.
Is a lot of your work now organizing against the war?
All of my time generally is on the issue of Iraq and, to some extent, police-community relations in Los Angeles and sweatshops, but it's all related. I teach and write, mainly, and as far as anti-war work, I don't see myself, and nobody's asking me to be a leader, quote-unquote, but I'm close to all the groups, and I do a lot of workshops and speeches around the country and hopefully work to unify people around some sense of strategy and priorities.
I know, Tom, I've read some of your material and talked to you about it a bit, but I know one thing you've been talking about a lot now is the counterinsurgency campaign in Iraq, the human rights atrocities, and the way human rights groups have to deal with that.
I'm a little puzzled. I think that the strategy in Iraq by Petraeus and the White House involves systemic human rights violations, 50,000 detainees, empowerment of the Shia Kurdish government. It's been, you know, found sectarian and brutal in even in White House reports on target lists, congressional studies by law enforcement officials. And yet, I don't see the kind of pressure to end the police state in Baghdad that I remember when we used to fight against the interventions in Central America with the death squads and Vietnam with the Phoenix program and the tiger cages. And it's strange, you know, the chief counterinsurgency advisor to General Petraeus, General Llewellyn, wrote a long article in 2004 calling for a global Phoenix program. And people.
Now, when you said that, I was amazed, Tom. I couldn't believe that.
He changed it in a later edition of it, but he started to refer to the CORDS program. The Revolutionary Development Program was the formal name during Vietnam, but it was known as the Phoenix Program then. People should wake up and ask, why are we implicated even with our tax dollars in this kind of behavior?
Explain what the Phoenix program is. I believe it was 40,000 rebel leaders that the United States had assassinated.
Well, let me give you an objective analysis as far as I can. The U.S. says that it was a counterinsurgency program that got out of control. What happened was that the Pentagon contracted out to the South Vietnamese Army, a program to go after the so-called Viet Cong infrastructure, that is, everybody in every village in South Vietnam who was identified as anti-war all the way over to pro-Viet Cong, pro-communist. They rounded all these people up and executed them, or by other accounts, all these people were killed in resisting their incarceration. But the numbers were staggering. 20,000 would be the low estimate, 70,000 the high estimate. Just was a systematic bloodbath based on identifying people through interrogation, making lists, going in at night, kicking down doors, dragging people out, and either torturing them or killing them in tens of thousands of cases. It was a scandal around the world. It was in the media around the world. It was condemned, and the U.S. Congress at the time did everything that it could to defund it, and it was actually eliminated. But of course, as with many of these things, like the School for the Americas, it gets renamed and surfaces. But now it's right at the heart of the Petraeus counterinsurgency strategy, not only in Iraq, but in Afghanistan.
It sounds to me like exactly what the French were doing to the Algerians.
If you remember, there's a scene in Battle of Algiers where the general, who looks strangely like Petraeus,
General Matou.
That's right, Matou. He takes on the press corps because the press corps says, let's call a spade a spade. Are you torturing people or not? And he said, we never use that word. We use the word interrogation.
Harsh interrogation.
But let's face it. These means are necessary to suppress the National Liberation Movement. And so I ask you a question. If you want us to keep Algeria French, are you ready to accept the consequences of that, yes or no? And our question should be, if you want to keep Iraq under American occupation, are you ready to accept the consequences? But people are not, including the media, are not analyzing what's actually going on in these secret prisons and dungeons. Does anybody seriously think Abu Ghraib was the only place where abuses were committed?
I think among progressives and liberals, there's this issue of immediate withdrawal or very fast withdrawal, and then the opposite, which is put out by even some liberals, saying that, well, that'll cause chaos, Iran, and all of the whole thing falls like dominoes, etc. So I'd just like if you have any comment on that, and then to sort of end it with where your thinking is on the presidential candidates and what they might do and what we need to do.
Well, you know, I'm always trying to ponder what public opinion is stuck on. And I think most people think the war was a disaster and should be ended. And they say it should be ended within a year. And they seem prepared to take the consequences. But the sticking point is that sector, that part of public opinion that worries for whatever reason, including humane reasons, for, well, is it true that things will get worse if we just pull out, quote-unquote? And this is a human rights community issue also, because many human rights groups argue that it could become worse, and therefore they don't advocate the complete withdrawal. So to address that, I think you have to, number one, say that this is a matter of cutting losses. Number two, blame the Republicans. Number three, say that we've got to make our best effort to end the war, and it's not going to be pretty. Number four, it means diplomacy trumps everything else. Diplomacy with Iran, diplomacy with people in the region and Europe, and you can't get a diplomatic offensive underway unless you declare your intention to withdraw at a time certain, because nobody will want to help the United States deal with issues like the refugee crisis, the absence of reconciliation, the corrupt failure of reconstruction, if the United States is asking those people, it could be the Jordanians or Syria or Iran or Saudi Arabia, to be accomplices or allies in the American occupation. So to get the diplomatic effort underway, you want to appeal to those countries that have stakes in calming the situation in Iraq down, and they will not, absolutely will not, participate in the occupation. So if you just reverse the call for getting out and diplomacy, to make diplomacy is the primary task for cleaning up the mess, and it can't begin without a declaration that you're getting out, I think that addresses the undecided opinion that we still have to address.
Tell us a little bit about where we are in the presidential election.
Who knows?
On this issue. Who knows?
I'm part of a network that's called Progressives for Obama .blogspot.com, and there's a lot of lively discussion and thinking there. We support Obama, but don't agree with all of his stands, which is natural because he defines himself as a centrist. Certainly, maybe the people that are planning Recreate 68 in Denver are right. I mean, I have no idea what's going to happen, and would just suggest people come to our blog site and blog and share their views. I was in North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and it looked solid for Barack. He's losing ground in North Carolina. There's no question about that.
One thing I think we could all agree on and hope for is that regardless of who gets what, we have a huge anti-war demonstration in the fall to put pressure on whoever is going to be the next president.
The first battle is to put up some votes on continued funding of the war, with or without conditions. Then comes anti-war protests at the Democratic Convention and a Republican Convention. Then there'll be a revival if this primary ends. There'll be a revival of a lot of money being spent on television and ground operations by an anti-war coalition against McCain, pointing out the connections between the war and the economy. And it'll go right through November. And if November there's a McCain victory, then I think people probably go back in the streets. If there's a Democratic victory, then people probably will begin a waiting game to see if the Democrats deliver. And if they don't, then you'll see big demonstrations early next year.
Tom, I'm not going to keep you anymore, but really, I really appreciate your work. And
thanks, Michael.
And your book, Ending the War in Iraq, is great. And why don't you give us the name of your newest book?
It's called The Tom Hayden Reader, Writing for a Democratic Society. It's participatory writing starting in 1961, I believe.
My question is, were you as good a writer then as you are today? And I think the answer is yes.
For some reason,
you just have a gift.
No, I'll tell you one thing. I've always been a writer more than an activist. But I was pulled into activism, and so I'm a unique mixture. I think the early writing is more utopian and idealistic, you know, the early youth. Then when I'm in office in the legislature, it's more op-eds denouncing a problem and proposing a solution. And then after, you know, the past 10 years, the writing becomes longer, more reflective on the development of these new movements in Latin America and the movements against globalization, against the war in Iraq, and trying to tie some things together that need to be said. It actually ends with an essay on torture in Iraq.
Well, that's great. I'm actually looking forward to that.
Not quite a Hollywood ending.
No, I thought your Ending the War with Iraq was really solid. Suggestions for the movement, the pillars at the end. I just thought it was an important book for people to read as you walk out and you say, what am I, you know, you walk out of a movie like Stop Loss and you say, what am I supposed to do? And I think your book is helpful.
But I'm glad that these movies are, particularly the first 15 minutes of Stop Loss, to show you what a battle in the ghetto of Baghdad is all about. That's an unbelievable 15 minutes. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, bye-bye.
Here on Law & Disorder, we've talked several times since December 2005 about how environmental activists in the United States have been targeted by the FBI and meted out unusually harsh prison sentences. Some call it the Green Scare, likening it to the Red Scare of the 1950s. Over a year ago, the National Lawyers Guild established a hotline for activists who've been targeted by the FBI on such charges. Today we're going to talk about the case involving Breanna Waters. Prosecutors claim that she acted as a lookout and conspired to set fire to the University of Washington Center for Urban Horticulture in 2001. This despite evidence presented by the defense that she was over 60 miles away at the time of the arson. Others claim responsibility for the fire, but Ms. Waters, a 32-year-old mother and violin teacher, may face up to 20 years in prison. The case was litigated by National Lawyers Guild member Bob Bloom. Today we talk with California civil rights attorney Ben Rosenfeld about her case. Welcome to Law & Disorder, Ben.
Good morning, Heidi.
Ben, who is Breanna Waters?
Breanna Waters is one of the targets of the FBI and federal government's Green Scare, or what they call Operation Backfire. She's an environmental activist and student, and a former student, at the time she was alleged to have committed the arsons that they accuse her of committing. She steadfastly maintains her innocence, and an award-winning filmmaker as well.
What's Operation Green Scare?
Operation Green Scare is the name given to the FBI's witch hunt against what they sort of sloppily lumped together as radical environmentalists, ELF or ALF, members, sometimes just anarchists. And they've been targeting these people since 9/11 in this kind of stepped-up so-called domestic terrorism witch hunt. And the reason people call it the Green Scare is because it harkens back to the darkest days of the Red Scare, when we went after people for one ideology and now people are being targeted for another.
What is the exact charge? Brianna was convicted.
Yes.
And she was convicted of being a lookout.
She was convicted of conspiracy to commit arson, and the conduct that they attributed to her was crouching in the bushes with the radio as a lookout while fellow conspirators set fire to a building at the University of Washington in May of 2001. The evidence, I should say, all points away from her, and the case was absolutely rife with government and prosecutorial misconduct, and the evidence in no way added up or pointed to her culpability. But the trial was one of the most rigged trials and worrisome spectacles I've ever seen in a courtroom.
Now, weren't there receipts showing that she, in fact, was at least 60 miles away at the time the arson was committed?
Yeah, the defense was delighted, or so they thought, when they dug up a receipt showing that she was in Olympia, Washington at the time the two informants, that is, participants turned state's evidence who testified against her in exchange for leniency, said that she was at a meeting prior to the commission of the arson in Seattle.
I think what you just mentioned in terms of the turning state evidence is a hallmark of a lot of these prosecutions. The government really intimidates individuals, often young activists who have committed maybe property crimes, but nothing life-threatening, and offers to strike plea agreements with them if they'll give names of others who may have been involved. And what we've seen is a lot of people giving names of individuals who actually weren't involved.
Well, sure, because what you're describing is a very traditional by-the-numbers sort of investigation and prosecution, but what's different here is they're wielding this huge cudgel over people's heads in the form of a so-called destructive device enhancement charge, which carries a mandatory minimum of 30 years. And so they accuse the people they've gone after in these cases of using a destructive device within the meaning of the statute, but the statute talks about grenades and missiles and bombs and sort of weapons of mass destruction and at least things that go boom. But in this case, the devices used were just delayed incendiary devices designed to give the arsonist time to get away. But they didn't explode. They simply burned slowly. And yet somehow through some tortured logic and I should say the collusion of the courts in these cases, they've managed to pervert these devices into so-called destructive devices.
You know, I wasn't that familiar with this whole issue for a while, and I had to teach somewhere in the East the other day. And I talked to a bunch of people from the West Coast who've been going through some of these cases, and I was just appalled. And it's exactly what you said. It's that they say 30 years or else, the enhancement charge, and then they cave in people because of that. And it's a way of really destroying a movement, an environmental movement. And it's something that on the East Coast, where we're broadcasting from, it's not well known at all, but when I talk to these activists, lawyers and others who spent their summers out there, it was really a shocking story as to what the government is doing now.
Well, the phenomenon of extracting false confessions out of people who are facing potential death sentences is, of course, well documented, and I would submit that probably a very similar psychology is at work in these cases when you're facing what really begins at a 30-year sentence, because added to that, of course, are the more standard sentences for arson and conspiracy. And so you're looking at really at life sentences. And I think that it probably has the same psychological toll and works to cause false accusations. People will say anything to get out of that.
Ben, what has your involvement been in this case and any others like it?
Well, I'm a member of the Civil Liberties Defense Center, which is a civil rights organization based in Eugene, Oregon, and the CLDC has provided legal resources and support to the activist community broadly and to some of the individual defendants and their attorneys who've been targeted in these cases.
We know you're on your way to court and appreciate your joining us. Just in the last couple of minutes, how many years is Brianna facing? Is there an appeal being brought?
Sure. Brianna, when she is sentenced on May 30th, if that day holds, is facing up to 20 years in prison because the jury convicted Breonna Waters of arson, but they hung on the conspiracy counts and the destructive device count. She faces up to 20 years for her conviction of arson. It's very interesting to observe that in the midst of the jury deliberations, other fires were set north of Seattle, within tens of miles of where the fire she was accused of participating in was set. And there's no doubt that whoever set those fires meant that they'd be connected back to this trial. And in fact, the government did everything it could to make those connections and engaged in what I think was probably tantamount to jury tampering. And indeed, the headline caught fire literally from coast to coast, and the federal government was there to make the connections to the Breonna Waters case. And so it's kind of remarkable, even in the midst of that, the jury was able to hang on these other charges, but we think that the whole process was severely polluted, and yes, there will be an appeal.
I understand that she has a child. Normally, people would be given, like Lynn Stewart, given bail pending an appeal, and instead they just took her and put her in jail. I thought that was in line with the cruelty of the whole prosecution.
Well, I think it definitely shows the cruelty of it, and they didn't seek jail time even for the informants who are confessed arsonists in these cases, and I should point out, who have confessed to committing more than just the one. And in this case, they literally ripped her from her three-year-old daughter, who was still breastfeeding at the time, and it is a tragedy within a tragedy, and incredibly painful to have observed. And there was a point later where traumatized jail guards literally had to rip this child's hands from her mother's hair while she was screaming at the end of a visit. And I've seen the two of them together, and they're a beautiful pair, and she's really an amazing child. And Breonna is an incredibly loving, smart, and devoted mother. It's a human rights tragedy as well as a miscarriage of justice.
Ben, it's great to hear from you again, and we're glad that you're a spokesperson on behalf of this and other cases. We look forward to having you on again to hear, hopefully, some positive news.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your attention to it.
Thanks, Ben.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
Today we hear excerpts from the third part of the event, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. That's the title of the memoirs recently released by Murat Kurnaz, who was detained at Guantanamo for 5 years. Kurnaz is a Turkish citizen and legal resident of Germany. He traveled to Pakistan to learn more about his Muslim faith and was later arrested at a checkpoint, handed to the United States, and eventually taken to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The event, presented by Friends of the Library, brought together a panel of attorneys from the United States and Germany who fought for Murat's release, as well as a Guantanamo chaplain who was accused of espionage and imprisoned. The panel was moderated by our own Michael Ratner. Speakers include Baher Azmi, professor at Seton Hall Law School, Bernhard Dock, a lawyer since 1983 who specializes in criminal law, and who's been a lawyer for Mr. Kurnaz since 2002, Wallace Shawn, an Obie-winning playwright and stage and screen actor, James Yee, the former U.S. Army Muslim chaplain of Guantanamo Bay, and Philippe Sands, an international attorney and professor of law at the University College in London. Some facts on Guantanamo. The number of people detained at Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba since January 2002 is 775. No trials have been completed to date. Four detainees have died in custody. The youngest known prisoner held in Guantanamo is 13, and the oldest is 98. 5% of detainees were actually captured by the United States. Let's now have a listen.
We have about 10 or 15 minutes before we can go to some questions, and I just want to get a... I have a lot of questions here. I have a couple for Bahar right now. One is, of course, you heard Philippe talk about three or four people being tortured at Guantanamo, and then I also would like you to give us some information about who has been at Guantanamo and what the statistics show, what the government's own witnesses show.
Sure. I'll start with the second one first. So a colleague of mine at Seton Hall Law School did, along with a number of students, a fairly exhaustive study of the government's own public allegations against all the detainees. So he looked at the government's reasons for detaining 535 detainees. And he did this on the backdrop of administration claims about Guantanamo that, for example, they're all captured on the battlefield, that they're the worst of the worst, hardened, vicious, the best trained killers in the world. These are the people who flew planes into the World Trade Center. And what he discovered was, of course, far from those exaggerated claims, which, of course, could only last as long as Guantanamo was as secret as the administration was able to keep it. And he discovered some interesting things. Only 6% of the detainees who wound up in Guantanamo were actually captured by United States forces on the battlefield. The balance, save for 2 or 3% he can't account for, were turned over by Pakistani forces or the Northern Alliance. Of all the detainees there, only 8%, according to the government's own allegations, were alleged to be al-Qaeda fighters.
The leaflets that were dropped over Afghanistan and Pakistan basically said to people, you can be rich, you will never have to work the rest of your life.
That's right.
If you turn over a Taliban or al-Qaeda fighter.
That's right. And Donald Rumsfeld said, and they're in Arabic and Pashto, Donald Rumsfeld boasted, we'll drop these over Afghanistan. They'll fall over Afghanistan like snowflakes in Chicago in December. And there are endless stories of people just being rounded up in this very tribal society. Political enemies are people just wishing to get rich. And there were numerous raids in Pakistan of mosques by corrupt police officials who held people at ransom, give us some money, or go to the Americans. And even the majority were not even have ever alleged to have engaged in a hostile act. 55% have not even alleged to have engaged in a hostile act. They're there merely because of some association with groups hostile to the United States. And that is one of the allegations, of course, against Murat Kurnaz, that he associated with someone who's a suicide bomber who actually isn't, but that also this group that he traveled with, Jamiat al-Tabliki, which has something around 40 million members and is avowedly a peaceful missionary group, that this group has at some time had members who have done things hostile to the United States without any allegation that Murat himself was aware of those or participated in them. And, of course, that theory would justify the detention of the 40-plus million members of Jamiat al-Tabliki in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India. And this process occurred, I think, fundamentally because guilt and innocence was irrelevant in Guantanamo. Guantanamo has nothing to do with adjudicating guilt and innocence or concern, but it's always been about interrogation, and that's interrogation free from the constraints of law, free from judicial intervention. So legal notions of guilt make no difference when there's the authority to hold somebody as they thought they had indefinitely, hold them in secret, and the opportunity for perpetual interrogation.
Chaplain Yee, you were, 76 days in a brig?
Yeah, 76.
Do you want to describe that at all or anything else you want to say in this conversation before we get to questions?
Before I go to that, some of the comments I wanted to make, passages that were read. The second passage that we heard with the interrogation tactics, I think it's clear that to try and elicit information or intelligence from trying to beat it out of someone, through electrical shocks or through, you know, chain suspension in the air are not effective measures to gather intelligence. And with the military interrogators who are doing this, I think that sends a message to us as, you know, who's training these people? I mean, where are they getting these techniques? Is the military showing them Hollywood movies in order to train them in interrogation? This is scary when we have to rely on military intelligence to contribute to protecting our national security. And my first thought is, you know, how adequate, how effective is our military intelligence when we know that they're engaging in this type of tactic to try and elicit information? Very ineffective. The other question is.
Wait one second. Let Philippe say something.
I think it's really important to put into context that there were a lot of people at Guantanamo, on the military side, at the FBI, in the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, who deeply objected to what was going on at Guantanamo. I think you knew many of those people, and it's very important that one not get the sense that somehow everyone there and at every US military base was strongly supportive of this type. There was an incredible tension that was underway between two different camps. One camp who thought, we've got to go all the way to protect ourselves, and another camp, which didn't prevail in relation to the guy I was looking at, Mohammed al-Qahtani, who strongly objected. And in relation to the really important point that James is making, what I learned when I started interviewing the people who were supportive, if you like, of the interrogation regime, was that they were influenced by things that you would find absolutely extraordinary. The television program 24. Jane Mayer wrote a great piece in The New Yorker on that subject. She didn't get to the point of identifying individuals who said, yes, it had an influence. I spoke to people who told me it had an influence. 24 had many friends. Something else which is not in the Vanity Fair piece, but which is in the book, and which will, I think, shock people in a sense even more. Alan Dershowitz, professor at Harvard Law School, wrote a book in August 2002 on using torture warrants. Since torture was going to happen anyway, let's legalize it and have the issuing of warrants. People who objected to techniques of interrogation at Guantanamo were met with the response, yes, but look, you've got distinguished Harvard Law School professors writing books saying it is fine. That was what was going on at the ground. And there was, you might say more about this battle that was going on. I don't know how much you were aware of in that period. But it's really important to get a sense that it was not a sort of homogenous view, let's just bash everyone, let's get everything out of them. And all these arguments were being rehearsed and fought out by different groups within the decision-making process. And the one group that emerges, I think, largely intact in terms of its reputation, in my eyes, are the military lawyers. Where things went wrong was through a very small group of politically appointed lawyers who essentially did the bidding of their political masters.
I would say that might be the case with Guantanamo, but the tactics that we heard being read were occurring in Afghanistan. So by the time things came to be at Guantanamo, yes, you had that inner tension within the military and people objecting to it. I myself there was objecting to even things less than what we heard in those interrogation tactics. But I think this raises the point that even if we closed Guantanamo, the prisons in Afghanistan is today where most of the prisoners are being held. I think less than 5 prisoners have been transferred to Guantanamo since the August of 2006. So where are those prisoners that are being captured now going? They're in Afghanistan prisons, in the prisons in Afghanistan, which we know even less about than Guantanamo. They're virtually hidden from any public view. The journalists
have no access to those as
don't
lawyers,
go there, don't interview personnel there like they do in Guantanamo. So I think that raises the question. Even if we closed Guantanamo, that doesn't solve the problem of actually how the U.S. is treating prisoners being held in the custody of our military, and I think that's something we really have to focus on. But going on to the other aspects, what was being in prison like? Before I even get to that, the aspects of Guantanamo that you read about. In that reading, you can see that the guards also played a role in abusing prisoners, and I saw that it was rather systematic, and it was this process which the military had to carry out what's technically known in prison operations as forced cell extractions. When a prisoner refuses to come out of his cell, when he needs to be taken out for whatever reason, they use this process where they have this team of guards dressed up in this riot gear, the shields, the knee pads, the chest protectors, and they essentially beat the prisoner into submission so they can drag him out. What was happening, and I saw this in Guantanamo, was they would use this forced cell extraction systematically to abuse the prisoners by coming up with silly reasons to do this to the prisoners. And we heard from the silly reasons that, you know, Murad experienced in the reading. But I saw in cases where, you know, a guard shift, for example, would give a prisoner a styrofoam cup. Certain prisoners were allowed to have a styrofoam cup to drink from. They also, the prisoners, used the styrofoam cup also to clean themselves with water after they used the toilet. So they wanted two styrofoam cups, one to drink from and one to use for hygiene purposes. So sometimes the guards, some of the guards, like you said, not all the people in the military were mean-spirited. Some of the guards would say, sure, here's your second cup, no problem. But the rule was you could only have one styrofoam cup. So when the next guard shift comes on and they see the prisoner with two cups, that means one of those cups is what they would call illegal contraband. And the punishment for that would be solitary confinement for 10 days or more. And the prisoner would be like, I'm not letting you take me to solitary confinement, these MSU, maximum security units that Murad was describing in that passage, just because I have a second styrofoam cup, which one of your guards gave me. And so then what would they do? They would call this IRF team, this immediate response force, carry out this forced cell extraction, beat that prisoner into submission, drag him out, put him in solitary confinement. So it was a systematic abuse. Under these silly reasons to carry out this violent extraction of the prisoner from his cell. And this was something that I raised concerns about to the chain of command, saying that this is the type of thing that is causing all the prisoners to riot, to cause disturbances, to go on hunger strikes, end up in complete chaos within the cell blocks. Again, it's an indication that the guards too played a role in humiliating and degrading the prisoners.
I'm not going to let you go on into your own prison experience because of time. I'm just going to really end with the last question to Bernard. You know, you hadn't seen a client for almost 5 years, and I'd like just to describe what it was to see Murat when you were in Germany.
Yeah, I was fighting for a kind of ghost client. I've never seen him. I just got an impression by what his mother was telling about him. And the reunion of Murat and his mother, I think it was the most moving moment in my 25 years as a lawyer. It was just incredible. And Murat had problems to identify his father. His father turned gray in these 5 years. His brothers were grown up, and the world went on. When he's been in Guantanamo, there were so many new things to discover. New money, we turned from the D-mark to the euro. He had never seen euros. New cell phones with colored displays, which can take pictures. And new cars, and on the way from Ramstein in southern Germany to Bremen, Murat was informed that his wife got split from him and asked for a divorce, and that his most loved uncle died. So it was a very sad moment for him. And then we stopped at the Autobahn. During the night, it was a clear sky, and Murat went off the car and walked to the side of the Autobahn and looked for 2 minutes in the sky and in the beauty and endlessness of the universe after being kept for 5 years in five square meters under permanent neon light. Nobody said a word, and it was an incredible, intense moment. And then we tried to prepare him for the moment when he will come in his home street expecting a huge, crazy media attention. And we proposed him to make a fake that Bahar Azmi pretends to be Murat and walking through the front door while Murat is coming in by the back door. And then he said, no, no, no. I've been for 5 years away. I take the front door. And so he kept his pride in Guantanamo, and I think that helped him to talk with Patti Smith, to walk without chains and to come back to normal and human life.
Oh, thank you. Good panel. I think, Paul, you're going to handle questions. The one last comment is, you know, we have a book, we have a man out of prison, but we still have Guantanamo continuing, as Chaplain Yee mentioned. We have Bagram continuing, and we have President Bush having just vetoed a bill that would have banned the CIA from doing water torture. So we're not close to finished with the struggle to really put this country back on some kind of page of fundamental rights.
And there's 5 years of my life, which you can get on your way out. There are many, 192 books has assembled many other books. What the World Should Know by Hugh Michael, For God and Country, James Yee's book, Lawless World by Philip Sands, and a medley of wonderful books by Wally Shawn, Final Edition, The Fever, Mary and Bruce, Aunt Dan and Lemon. So you can inform yourself more, and I think an evening like the one we've experienced tonight should make us, as you said, Michael, aware that the struggle is hardly over. It has barely begun, as it were. But there are questions, some of them quite contentious, for everybody here, and I will voice them. I've chosen some. We had about 50. To the extent torture produces useful information to save lives, isn't the deprivation of legal rights justified?
Philip,
this is for you, maybe.
Is torture effective?
No.
No.
It's a very simple answer. It doesn't. Firstly, there is no evidence that it does produce results. I focused on one example in the book that I wrote. It's not dealt with in the Vanity Fair piece, but it's dealt with in the book. I spoke at length with the head of Mohammed Al-Qahtani's exploitation team, and they got nothing out of him. But more to the point, he explained to me that in these sorts of circumstances, there is only one moment at which one gets useful information with aggressive interrogation techniques, and I'm not for a moment suggesting that it ought to be used, and that is within the first 24 hours of capture. Thereafter, it produces no utility at all. And there are a number of ways of answering the question. It doesn't produce results. It's unlawful in all circumstances. The United States and 160 other states or so are parties to a convention which says there are no exceptions to the rule in which it can be used. It undermines moral and other authority, and that's what's happened to the United States, which has paid an enormous price for engaging in torture and will continue to pay that price for many years. And I think the answer to the question is a very simple one. No.
On this stage, Mark Bowden spoke eloquently, one might say, about the ticking bomb scenario and defended it. Is that...
Paul, was he able to give you a single example in which it had ever happened? The Israeli Supreme Court dealt precisely with this issue, and it gave an extraordinary judgment in which it basically said it is the lot of a democracy to fight with one hand tied behind its back. We will deal with the ticking time bomb situation when we get there. We are not aware of any situation in which it has arisen, and no one is able to give an example. And certainly in relation to Guantanamo and Afghanistan and Iraq, nothing got near to the ticking time bomb scenario. It's people like Alan Dershowitz who raised this type of situation to open the door. And once you've opened the door, even a tad, it's all over.
People will hear time bombs ticking everywhere once you've opened the door.
I would say that someone who may really seriously be involved in a ticking time bomb situation would be so dedicated to that cause would prefer to die so the ticking time bomb goes off. And so torture, you know, won't get you anywhere. That person will die.
Yeah, I mean, I just Philippe said it exactly right. It's so, I guess I rolled my eyes when I heard the ticking time bomb. And it's just so exhausting because it doesn't exist. It's just an utter fantasy. So we can argue against a situation that's never, argued about a situation that's never demonstrably happened in our history as to justify a regime of total lawlessness, or we can recognize this for what it is, a wedge to allow not only interrogation in some infinitesimal circumstance, but an entire regime that depends on brutality to sustain itself, which is the result.
How did you assure yourself of Murat Kurnaz's innocence?
It was quite easy because I looked at the government's reasons, which they were obligated to produce as part of the legal case against him. I've given you two of the reasons. One, which is legally incredibly attenuated, that is, he was associated with a 40 million member group, and the other, which was factually preposterous, that his buddy was a suicide bomber, in fact, walking along the streets of Bremen, which the U.S. government, had they cared, could have discovered with a five-minute call to the Bremen prosecutor, which they declined ever to bother to do. In addition, there are public reasons offered for the detention, and then the government files classified reasons in a secure facility outside of Washington, D.C., that I, with a security clearance I obtained, was able to review. I won't sort of forget the moment I looked at that evidence, because what it revealed not only is that not only did he have no connections to terrorism, U.S. military intelligence concluded that he had none and did so as early as 2002. They repeated that conclusion in 2003, 2004, and the FBI made a similar conclusion. And we were able to, through a related litigation here in New York under the Freedom of Information Act, declassify that evidence. So it's available for all to see. I mean, that sort of demonstrates, I think, my earlier point that Guantanamo has nothing to do with guilt or innocence. It's a lawless vehicle.
One more word to that. I was often asked when I took over this case, how could you be convinced that he's innocent? I think to get engaged in this Guantanamo case, not a question of guilt or innocence. Guantanamo is illegal and immoral from the beginning. Nobody deserves Guantanamo, and even the bad guys have the right for a fair trial and the right not to be tortured. And I think in the discussion with the Conard case, we should avoid to focus always on innocence, 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 because all the other ones have, we should not forget them, and we should not create an atmosphere, the bad ones deserve Guantanamo, and some of the good ones, the innocent ones, we get them out.
As someone who actually interacted with Murat Kurnaz when I was down in Guantanamo, and other prisoners, with the respect to guilty or innocence, In the courts of law, we often sometimes see circumstantial evidence being used to convict someone. Well, I think Guantanamo is a great case of circumstantial evidence to exonerate prisoners, because I think the reality is that if the U.S. had really captured a legitimate terrorist suspect, those individuals were not brought to Guantanamo. They were put in CIA black sites. So the vast majority of those who were brought to Guantanamo were not in any way serious terrorist suspects that could even in any way be associated with 9/11. So that circumstance, I think, is the reality in my view, of the situation of those prisoners who were brought to Guantanamo very early on, and the real terror suspects were those in the CIA black sites.
You know, we at the center who represent or coordinate almost all the cases right now, as it turns out, when we started the cases, Rumsfeld said they're the worst of the worst. They'll chew through hydraulic cords, all the stuff. It turned out, in the majority of cases, by far, not to be that. But the position today, to me, is, and I think most of us on this panel would have it, is that either you charge these people with a crime and try them in a court, or you release them. I mean, that's what we've said from the very beginning. That's what we say today. And yes, there may be some people there who, they don't belong in Guantanamo, but may belong on trial. But then try them.
That was the third part from An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.